You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Natural disasters, public health scares, terrorist attacks, and nuclear war are all part of a day's work for Mitchell Zucker, the main character of Nathaniel Rich's new novel, Odds Against Tomorrow. That's because Mitchell's job involves predicting worst-case scenarios for his clients, a kind of risk management of the grandest proportions. But then a worst-case scenario becomes a real-life disaster, and Mitchell is tested personally and professionally. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Very pleased that it brings Nathaniel Rich to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
How does Mitchell get a job predicting risk?
Well, he has a natural inclination towards it. He's the kind of guy who stays up late at night doing research about asteroids hitting the planet or the new strain of antibiotic-resistant bird flu. And he's working at a high finance firm in New York, a kind of alternate reality, J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs. And he's increasingly receiving emails from a mysterious new firm called Future World that promises to predict the future and find out what you need to be afraid of. And he's kind of drawn into that.
Well, people who invest really do worry about that kind of risk, don't they?
They do. And, I mean, it's essentially a version of risk analysis, which is, you know, there are risk departments at all kinds of major companies that handle finance. And I met with some people who do that kind of work when I was researching the book. And the original premise for this company came from a misunderstanding I had from a conversation with a friend who's in corporate law, who's explaining a new kind of – this was in 2007 – a new kind of corporate scam to create a high – a market in high risk. And I still don't really know what he was talking about, but that became the seed for Future World.
And you set this book in the kind of nebulous near future, but it's pretty much today, isn't it?
Yeah, it's essentially today plus 2 or 3 years. It's never explicit. And I felt that I didn't want to write a kind of conventional dystopian novel that's set, you know, 20, 25 years or more in the future.
After the great nuclear blast.
After the blast, yeah. I feel that form is to some degree quaint at this point, and that there's enough dystopian aspects of what's going on in today's world that I think a better way to handle these themes is by just engaging more rigorously in what's happening right now.
Well, we can this is quite reasonable. There are corporations that are quite vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say everything in the novel, all of the facts mentioned are real. So Mitchell, in working for Future World, has to do all kinds of research and discover things, every possible worst-case scenario that could potentially affect a company.
So you had to do that same research.
So I did that same research, and I started to, like Mitchell, to go a little bit insane, you know, learning about the super volcano that lies beneath Yellowstone, for instance, that has erupted, we know, 2 times in the history of the planet, both times essentially making every animal go extinct. The first time was, I think, 2.1 million years ago. The next one was about 1 million years ago, and so I sort of figured, you know, we're due now. So there are a lot of scenarios like this. You know, there's a fault line on 125th Street, for instance, people don't know about that can trigger an earthquake anytime. And so,
because we tend to feel safe in New York, earthquakes are for California or other places, but we have fault lines, a number of fault lines, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot
there's
of things.
There's one in Yonkers.
There's a lot of things that, and you know, the Indian Point is on a fault that they didn't know about when they built it, and that's, I think, 25 miles from New York. So there's if you want to worry about things, there are plenty of things to worry about in New York, and the most likely one, I realized as I was beginning research for the novel, was a major hurricane hit in New York City.
Well, for somebody like Mitchell, who's a worrywart to begin with, does this have an effect on the way he deals with life?
Yeah, well, he has an inclination towards obsession and paranoia, probably, and then he gets this job, which in some ways is the kind of best possible job for him, and at the same time is his own personal worst-case scenario, because he goes down a kind of wormhole of obsession.
What kinds of scenarios does Mitchell predict for his clients?
Well, it's the full gamut. I mean, he begins with war, nuclear war, war with China. He goes into natural disasters, hurricanes, flooding, earthquakes. He goes into asteroids, and and finance disasters and everything you can possibly think of. And by the when he reaches his kind of breaking point, he gets into eschatology and revelation and apocalypse. And it's about at that point, you know, at the end of the first third of the novel that he essentially has a breakdown.
But also is declared a prophet.
Yeah, so then what happens is he a worst case scenario actually hits New York City, which is a Category 3 hurricane in the novel called Tammy, and that causes great flooding. And at that point, he's uniquely prepared to profit. And then, as in the aftermath, he is appreciated by the public as a prophet.
Does predicting possible catastrophes make people more prepared when the actual disaster occurs? Because we saw a lot of people warned about Sandy who just simply ignored it. I even did some live reports from Brighton Beach where people were saying, we're Russians, we're tough. And then they wound up being stuck in their homes or watching their houses destroyed.
Yeah, no, I mean, my own mother, who has known about this book for many years, during Sandy, was talking about how she wanted to go to the FDR to look at the waves. And so I think as much as that, and that in many ways is what the novel's about, is, you know, all of this information is out there. We knew to take Sandy, we knew what would happen in a Category 1 or higher hurricane. We knew the type of flooding that would happen. We knew about where the water levels would be. And so, you know, I drew all of that information from an Army Corps of Engineer, primarily from an Army Corps of Engineer report from 1995 that had laid it out very specifically. So when Sandy did happen, I was editing the final proofs of the novel at that point. I actually didn't have to change anything because as shocked as the tone of, you know, the reporting was, in fact, the people who study this type of stuff, the government and scientists, knew exactly what would happen.
So you didn't change anything?
No, I had to insert one paragraph about Sandy because it does take place in the near future. And at one point, Mitchell is going back and looking at previous flooding. And so there was a sentence that was said something like, well, the last time there was major flooding was in the 1992, I think, Nor'easter. So I had to insert one paragraph about then there was Sandy, but people forgot about it soon after.
But also there was Hurricane Katrina, and you live in New Orleans, don't you?
That's right.
Did you go there to research the book and wind up living there?
I went there to finish the book. I'd always wanted to move there, and in 2010 I wanted to you know, have my own little escape from New York for a moment to at least finish the novel. I fell in love with the city. And the one thing that I really did change is the final section of the novel, which takes place after the storm. You know, I think living in New York, reading about Katrina, we understood intellectually what had happened there. But actually living there, speaking with people who are still traumatized 6 years after the event, 7 years after the event, and seeing the way the extent of the transformation of the landscape in certain areas, particularly the Lower Ninth that I wrote a piece about for the New York Times Magazine, it was shocking to see the level of transformation. And so that influenced absolutely the final section of the novel.
My guest is Nathaniel Rich, who's written a book called Odds Against Tomorrow. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And a listener wonders whether there's any connection in your mind between what you've written here and Robert Wise's famous film with the same title.
That good question. I took shamelessly took the novel's title from a great film noir from 1959, I believe, with Robert Ryan, Odds Against Tomorrow. And I would say that the title, I feel justified in doing so because I think the title works better for my novel. There's a pun on the word odds because Mitchell's always predicting the odds of things happening. Whereas with film noir, it was a marketing ploy. They had all these great titles that had nothing to do with the film. So you can, if you look at a list, as I did when I was trying to come up with a new name of the novel, there are all these crazy things that, you know, fear of death, you know, the killing, the big knife, the big clock, et cetera. And so, you know, I'm thinking it's a good, it's something I might try to do in the future. It's an easy way to get titles.
You mentioned that your mother read it all along. Your mother's an editor at HarperCollins?
Yeah, that's right.
And your father is Frank Rich. And your brother Simon is also a novelist. Did your parents encourage everybody, the kids, to go into writing as well?
It's probably a question you get as well. No, I think if anything, they knew better than other parents the pitfalls of a life spent as a writer. So they did not encourage us at all. In fact, until recently.
Did they want to cut down on the risks for you?
Well, I think they hoped that I would become... I mean, until recently, my mother was encouraging me to go into finance or law and was saying, you know, I think you'd really be a great lawyer. But they also have – they don't really have a leg to stand on if they want to discourage us because they do similar things.
Now, Mitchell works for a man named Chernobyl. Mm-hmm. A little play on word there. Mm-hmm. Another disaster. By the way, does a job like Mitchell's actually exist? Are there people who are doing this kind of thing?
There are people who do risk analysis and who work for corporations, and their job is to predict what could happen, and then they can sort of structure their investment strategies around that. But it's not this kind of cynical indemnification. But such a thing, I did learn, could very easily exist. It would just take a little line in a law passed in New York State, perhaps inserted by the local state senator, and this kind of thing happens all the time.
In a recent piece in the New York Times travel section about an Amtrak train trip from New Orleans to Los Angeles, you wrote about Michelle, a woman who's very afraid that the train might derail or collide with another. I guess instead of fear of flying, she has fear of riding. She sounds like the perfect client for Future World.
Yeah, I was excited to find her. I mean, she had seen all the Final Dimension movies where everybody dies in every movie, and there are a lot of train crashes. But yeah, in the last few years, as I've been doing some journalism between working on the novel, I think I've been drawn to a lot of subjects that would help me research the book.
How do you meet somebody like that?
Michelle, I sat next to her on the train.
Are you drawn to people like that? Are they drawn to you?
I think I am drawn. I probably am drawn to people like that. I'm drawn to obsessives of any kind. And that for me is the uniting theme of all of the work I do is obsession.
A lot of the disaster movies destroy New York or Los Angeles. And this one has a major impact on New York.
Yeah. And that's actually one thing I wanted to avoid, however, in writing this novel. I did not want it to be a kind of a novel version of one of these disaster, Independence Day or Armageddon or Deep Impact, which I just saw for the first time this week. And I think there are all these Hollywood images in our mind, and those are essentially cliches. And I think when writing about anything, you want to avoid cliches and break them apart. And so I tried to focus the disaster scenes very closely on Mitchell and his perspective. And so it's a very – you don't get these big wide angle views of the city. It's really the experience that someone would have if they're, you know, the lights go out in their house and they have to get out of the city.
And FEMA never gets mentioned in the disaster movies. Things like FEMA, but you can include it in this book.
Yeah, you have to include FEMA. I think that's probably a result of living in New Orleans. It's impossible to go a day without hearing the acronym. But there's a little bit of FEMA, but I also didn't want there to be a overtly political edge or really a polemical edge either. I wanted to go into these issues and try to understand what living in a time, in a culture that's obsessed by fear, what does that do to us? And, you know, what should we be afraid of? And what should we worry about obsessing over too much?
I'm always curious about how writers choose the names of their characters. Chernobyl, I understand. Mitchell Zucker, it could be any name. Hurricane Tammy, is there a reason that you gave the hurricane that name?
Hurricane Tammy started off as – well, there's a list of hurricane names that is prepared that 6 years in advance. So we know the next 6 years of hurricanes. So I started with that. I originally had Nostromo, but that seemed a little too pretentious or literary or ominous. And then I thought it might be more interesting and kind of characteristic that it would be a name that you might not associate with a terrible storm. But yeah, the names tend to be the administrator that runs the agency that writes the names. It tends to be their names, their children's names, their wives' names become the names of the storms.
We haven't even gotten to some of the other parts of the plot, the women and such, but that's why people read these novels. And my great thanks to Nathaniel Rich, who is also the author of The Mayor's Tongue, and his essays and short fiction have appeared in Harper's, the New York Review of Books, McSweeney's, New York Times Magazine. His latest, a novel that's getting wonderful reviews. In fact, just yesterday, the Sunday Times had a fabulous review. It's called Odds Against Tomorrow, and it's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.